The festival begins with smoke, not music. Meat hangs over open fires on Kariakou. The air thick with salt and seasoning, while drums are carried out under the open sky. It looks like a show for visitors, a postcard version of African memory in the Caribbean. But the real shock is this. Some of the oldest surviving Maroon rituals in the Grenada Island chain are now scheduled, branded, and sold as an experience in the same space where running to the bush once meant the difference between life and death. For 3 days in late April, Kariakou's Maroon and String Band Festival turns a small island into a stage for something that was never meant to be seen by the colonial eye. You have elders in white clothing, youth in jeans and festival t-shirts, visitors with cameras, and local bands tuning up instruments that trace back to European string music and West African rhythm at the same time. Somewhere between the fires and the loudspeakers sits a harder question. Why did these particular Maroon rituals survive here, on this small island, long enough to be turned into a festival, when so many similar practices on nearby Grenada and other islands were erased, driven into churches, or left unrecorded? To feel that question properly, you have to step back into the old plantation Caribbean. Kariakou is not a famous island in the history books. It sits north of Grenada, closer to the Grenadines than to the big plantations that dominate most narratives of sugar and slave revolt. It was worked hard by enslaved Africans on estates owned by French and British planters, but it never became a giant in sugar in the way Barbados or Saint Domingue did. That peripheral status mattered. Out of the shipments of people forced across the Atlantic, Kariakou ended up with a particular concentration from parts of West Africa that included Temne-speaking communities, brought into Scottish and other British networks that were more interested in steady profit than fame. On the ground, this meant small islands of power and small islands of resistance. The plantation records list names, numbers, punishments, births, runaways. They do not tell you in any detail how people gathered at night, which drums they played, or which ancestral spirits they called. Those things appear instead in fragments, in later ethnographic work, in songs passed down, and in festivals like the one now held each April. Under slavery, Maroon activity in Grenada and its surrounding islands was a real problem for planters. Runaways moved through hills and bush, built small camps, and created pathways of information and survival. Some of those communities were crushed, some quietly absorbed back into plantations, some folded into free villages after emancipation. Not all of them left clear paper trails. What did survive in a more visible way on Kariakou was Big Drum. In those ceremonies, you can still find nations of African memory, each represented by a set of rhythms and songs that are called out in turn. It is not a museum piece, and it is not a pure African survival. It is a Caribbean creation that holds together fragments of language, rhythm, and ritual authority. Through Big Drum and Maroon feasting, people on Kariakou found a way to honor ancestors, settle disputes, and mark life events under and after slavery. The island's limited size, its close-knit communities, and the continuity of certain families and lineages helped keep those practices alive when elsewhere, more aggressive missionary campaigns, heavier plantation reorganization, or different migration patterns broke them up. Imagine one of those historical gatherings in the 19th century. In present tense, the plantation day is done. Night falls fast. People slip away from the main roads, moving in twos and threes toward a clearing known by everyone but mentioned carefully in front of no one. The ground is uneven. A bit of bush cleared for the purpose. A drum head is tightened. A fire coaxed into life. There is meat, but not in the quantity you would see at a festival today. There is rum. There is cassava. There is talk in low voices. The drum starts, slow and steady, and dancers move into the open space. Names of African nations are called, each rhythm bringing up a different way of moving, a different way of remembering. No posters, no schedule online, no festival title. If a colonial officer stumbles on this, it becomes evidence of disorder, superstition, or rebellion. If he does not, it is a night in which a community that is supposed to be broken claims time, space, and sound for itself. Now come back into the present on Kariakou, with a microphone stand where that clearing might have been. The festival now has sponsors and a 3-day timetable. One day is centered on the Maroon feast and Thanksgiving. Another leans into string band performances in the town and on the beach. Another folds in school groups or cultural showcases. a national tourism site, calls it one of the purest cultural experiences in the world. The marketing language leans on words like heritage, authenticity, and ancestral gratitude. It is easy to see the gain. Culture bearers get support. Younger people have a stage to learn and perform. Visitors witness something deeper than a beach party. But it is also easy to miss what is being traded in the process. The string band element tells its own layered story. On the surface, these are small acoustic bands playing guitars, violins, mandolins, mandolin family instruments, tambourines, maracas. It sounds closer to old-time European dance music than to the heavy drumming people associate with African roots. Underneath, though, the repertoire holds stories of migration, labor, and island life. Sailor songs, work songs, love songs, humorous songs about local events, all carried in a style that leaks across the colonial lines between Europe and Africa. That mix is not a neutral fusion. It emerged from a world in which enslaved and later free people were forced to adopt and adapt European instruments and forms while smuggling their own sense of timing, phrasing, and social commentary into them. When the Kariakou Festival pairs maroon rituals with string band concerts, it is staging not just a celebration but a history of cultural negotiation under power. At this point, the unresolved question starts to bite a little deeper. Why here, like this? Why does this island hold a branded maroon and string band festival, while nearby places with similar histories offer only fragments of comparable practices or festivals that are less explicitly tied to maroon identity? Part of the answer lies in local initiative. Cultural workers, historians, and community leaders on Kariakou pushed to formalize and protect big drum and maroon feasts before they vanished under the pressure of migration, imported church practices, and the global media flow. Part lies in timing. The late 20th and early 21st centuries brought a wave of interest in heritage tourism and cultural festivals across the Caribbean. Governments and tourism authorities began to frame older rituals as national treasures rather than embarrassing relics. But another part of the answer is more uncomfortable and less clear. When colonial authorities created the archives we now rely on, they decided which practices were worth describing and how. Maroon gatherings often show up in those papers only when they threaten property or public order. Everyday rituals of survival, healing, and spiritual protection rarely get more than a dismissive line. That means we may be exaggerating the uniqueness of Kariakou's visible survival simply because we have better modern documentation and more festival branding, while equally rich traditions elsewhere were forced to move indoors, to church halls, or into forms that do not call themselves maroon at all. Walk again through the festival in the present tense, this time with that in mind. A tourist steps off the ferry from Grenada, walking toward the sound of drums at a heritage park. Stalls line the path, selling smoked meat, fish, ground provisions, and local drinks. A banner announces the Maroon and String Band Music Festival, with dates and sponsors. The tourist holds up a phone to film as dancers in traditional clothing circle the big drum, moving in patterns that carry old meanings, whether or not he knows them. He hears an announcer explain that this is a Thanksgiving for life and harvest, a way of honoring the ancestors who survived slavery and carried their culture forward. He may not realize that in another era, a white visitor in that space is most likely a colonial officer, and his presence would mean danger, not funding. On the hill above or in the back rows, elders watch. Some of them are culture bearers, who fought to keep Big Drum alive when it was dismissed as backward or unchristian. Some are watching to see whether the line has been crossed between a community ritual and a show for outsiders. Young performers, meanwhile, are rehearsing choreographed versions of dances that were once improvised inside tight circles of trust. The songs are being compressed into stage-length pieces instead of stretching out as long as the spirit or the night required. Every time the festival runs, it protects something by keeping it in public view. It also risks bending that thing toward what visitors, funders, and cameras expect to see. Across the water, in Jamaica, maroon communities mark treaty anniversaries and historic victories with festivals of their own. They have their own battles over land rights, political recognition, and cultural control. In Suriname, maroon groups fight for forest territories against mining and logging. The Caribbean is full of maroon descendants who do not call themselves that, but whose family histories include some variation of running into hills, disappearing into bush, or holding a line on land when the plantation system cracked. For many of them, there is no glossy festival poster. Their rituals live in church gatherings that mix African and Christian forms, in village wakes, in small seasonal celebrations, or in everyday practices of herbal knowledge and dream interpretation. The visible festival at Kariakou sits like the tip of a much larger, less documented structure. The visible festival at Kariakou sits like the tip of a much larger, less documented structure. For diaspora listeners, especially those meeting this history through a podcast or audiobook script, there is a temptation to treat a festival like a convenient doorway. You can look up the dates, book a ticket, arrive in time for the opening ceremony, and feel you have touched something deep. In a way, you have. Standing before a big drum on Kariakou and watching dancers call out the nations of African memory is not trivial. Eating smoked food at a maroon feast on that island connects you, at least briefly, to a line of people who refuse to let their rituals die. But the deeper connection is not automatic. It depends on whether you come as a consumer of experience or as someone willing to sit with the tension between maroon practices as survival codes and maroon festivals as content. By now, the survival anomaly that opened this story should feel sharper, not softer. Kariakou's maroon and string band festival survived because people refused to let it go, because the island's social fabric allowed rituals to remain visible long enough to be rebranded as heritage, and because states and tourism markets decided they could live with and profit from fugitive history on a stage. Other places made different choices or had different pressures. Their maroon descendants are no less real, but their practices were forced into other shapes. The archive reflects those choices unevenly. We hear drums loudly where a festival exists. We may miss quieter echoes where no banner announces maroon at the gate. So when you watch a clip from the Kariakou Festival in your feed or see it on a tourism page, the question is not just, is this authentic? The more pressing question is, authentic for whom and under what conditions? A maroon tradition that once depended on being invisible has become most visible at the point where it is safest for the state and most attractive to visitors. That visibility can empower younger Kariakouans to claim their heritage. It can also flatten their history into a symbol that stands in for all maroon experience, even when that experience elsewhere is still contested, criminalized, or ignored. In the end, the festival smoke clears, the drums are carried away, and the island returns to its quieter rhythms. The question that hangs in the air is this: when a culture born in flight and refusal becomes a scheduled festival on someone else's calendar, are we witnessing a hard-won victory of survival, or the first steps toward a new kind of capture?